Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucksters, what the fuckadelics? What's happening? This is Mark Maron. This is WTF. This is my podcast. Thank you for being here. Today on the show, Aaron Draplin from Draplin Design Company. This is a guy, how do I explain this? I'm not even sure how we came together. I think someone said I should talk to him, and then I did a little research on him, and he seemed like an interesting character. He is the overseer of Draplin Design Company, Mr. Aaron James Draplin. He's a self-made man. He's an obsessed man. He's obsessed with logos and design. I don't know much about design, but he speaks to people about this. He's a charismatic man. He happened upon something in his design practice. These field notes, blank books, became very popular, and he designed them. And now he's got this whole racket going. And I wanted to learn a little bit about design. I've been a little fascinated with design here and there. I read a book about this guy who invented planned obsolescence. I was sort of obsessed from that point on. What was this guy's name? Was it Brooks Stevens? Yes, Brooks Stevens. I became sort of obsessed with the idea of planned obsolescence. And I believe he was the guy that figured that out. He was an industrial designer. Now, I don't know if Draplin is an industrial designer. He could be. But anyways, there was things about design that I was fascinated about and I knew nothing about. And I emailed or tweeted at or somehow got in touch with Aaron Draplin, and we talked, and I found him to be a compelling individual. And when I was up in Portland a while back, him and I sat at the headquarters of Draplin Design Company and we talked it out. And that's what's on the show today. You can go to draplin.com and see the stuff. He did my poster. We did a poster for the show. He's an all-around design guy. He's got patches and posters and these field notebooks and combs. And yeah, you got to go. It's hard to explain. He's got a little design empire. And you'll hear him talk about it in just a few minutes. What else is going on? There's a couple of things going on, actually. Looking at an empty deck with a few sad IKEA chairs that were in tremendous disrepair. Just because the finish was off and they just looked old. And I expressed some interest in getting new patio furniture. Then you go look at new patio furniture and there's all these sets and things and umbrellas. And then I thought, why don't I just put a picnic table out there? Just like a classic picnic table, like a cheap fucking, just regular old standard picnic table out on my deck. And my girl, Sarah, the painter, for my birthday, bought me a pine assembled unfinished picnic table. Just a fucking, you know, the kind that you're like, hey, is that a place to eat on the side of the road? Yeah, there's a picnic table there. Well, now when I walk out of my house, I'm like, is there a place to eat on my deck? Oh shit, look, there's just a picnic table there. So now I have a picnic table. We painted it red, stained it red, because that's what picnic tables are in my mind. So now it's just like, it's like camping at one of those places where you don't have to eat on the ground. My deck is now a campground where I don't have to sit on the floor in my tent. I can just sit at my picnic table. I know it's not really camping, but it's all I can handle. So here's the deal. We're still checking out some of the old Lorne discussions that I've had on the show. Hopefully these will give some context to my upcoming interview with the Buddha, the Lorne, the devil, whatever you want to call him, whatever. I've thought all those things. Now, the thing about this clip, this is me and Jason Sudeikis. This is from episode 205 back in 2011. And I think it's around the first time I felt like it was becoming necessary to have Lorne Michaels on the show. All right, so this is me and Sudeikis. And I'm tentative. You can hear in the clip. But obsessed. Always obsessed. So this is me and Jason Sudeikis from episode 205 in 2011.
You know, like, I feel like the more people I talk to from that show, yeah, on this show, I feel like I'm circling Lorne. Like, there's part of me like...
To be on here?
Yeah.
I'll definitely say something.
Dude, because, like, I just wrote Jimmy.
Yeah.
Because, like, I've had this weird story with him. And, like...
With Jimmy or with Lorne?
With Lorne.
Yeah, no, I've heard it. Yeah, of course.
You know, and I feel like he brought me in there to teach me a lesson. Mm-hmm. And now, like, you know, I want him to do it again.
Yeah.
Like, I would like him to feel... That, like,
would you go, to him?
Sure.
Yeah.
I'd like him to feel that.
Because he would never come to this fucking place.
No, I know. No. No, I'd like him to feel that whatever I'm doing, that whatever recognition I have is,
I mean, there's
really
no room in here for the throne. I mean,
I know that.
No, no.
But, like, in my mind, I believe he would think, like, you know, like, well, Marin's back and he's doing a thing, and but it's really nothing. You know, like, I want him, there's part of me that wants him to, like, to have that attitude and let me sit with him for an hour.
I would coach
him on the attitude, but if you can put it in his ear, that'd be amazing.
I would absolutely encourage him to do so. I think he's fascinating.
I think that there's part of me that thinks, like, he would want to.
Because
I know he's pretty private. And he doesn't talk to many people, and I know that, like, you know, I've had a lot of people from the show on. Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly from your generation. I've had Hader. Yes, I've had Armisen. I've had Seth
Mulaney.
I've had Mulaney. And I know
Amy, yep.
And Fallon, and yes, I know a lot of people listen to it over there.
Yeah,
I just like
that's what highly regarded throughout all circles, stand up, improv. I mean, it's. Yeah. God,
if we could pull that off, like, I don't know, like, if he would even remember me, but I know that because I did Conan
because
I auditioned for the show.
He's remarkably sharp. That guy gives a damn.
Like, no,
That's one of the things. Like, he's there.
Yeah.
Like, it's not a emeritus, executive producer emeritus whatsoever. That dude is, it's his show. Like, you know that going in. That's why.
Yeah.
That's why if you get mad, you're mad about something that you're doing, probably not something he's doing, because you're only there because of him.
Well
every Saturday.
Well, yeah. let me know what happens. Yeah. I'll remind you.
Please. I you won't have to. I mean, when I see him, I'll go, wow, so I'm supposed to do something I don't want to do. Oh, right. Ask him if he wants to do the podcast.
I don't know how you would ask him.
I ask him things.
I think you should tell him I did it. And, you know, have you listened to
course.
It? Like, you know, start off like that.
Yeah, please. Help me. Help
yeah.
me. Yeah, no, I know what to do.
Okay.
I'm the one that works there, you know.
So that was more than 4 years ago. Crazy. And it's finally happened. And I'm sorry to say, I guess you'll have to wait and find out if he really did put me in my place or he didn't. Or if he even remembered our meeting. All questions will be answered. For me, maybe. But it's coming. It's definitely coming. So here's what I want to talk about. I had sort of a shitty experience last night. Watching the Amy Schumer special that was recorded. I believe they broadcast it live from the Apollo on October 17th. Now, I generally don't watch other comics, and, you know, unless they're good friends. Mine, I love Amy, but I just don't make it a habit because I want to keep my head clean. And as you know, I just taped an hour plus special in Chicago at the Vic Theater. That was back on June 6th. I taped it. I'd been working that material for about a year. My special will be released on Epix in December. I'm very proud of the special. I was very excited about it. I thought I did a good job. I planned. I prepared. There's callbacks in it. It's a theater hour, an honest-to-God theater hour after my last special, Thinky Pain, which was a club hour, a loose club hour. I wanted to do a tight theater hour. I came pretty close, and I'm excited for you to see it. But I turned on Schumer's special, and I love Schumer. But I wanted to see what the, you know, what the stand-up's looking like and how she's doing. Because I, you know, I talked to her years ago in here before she was, you know, the big comedy star that she is now. And I'm watching the special and I'm liking it. I'm having a good time. I like her. I like Dirty. I like her shamelessness. And then she sets up a bit. She does a little bit and it's a lot like one of my bits. And the thing is, like, I didn't even think that she took it. And I knew I didn't take it from her. It's just one of these things we deal with as comedians. It's like, well, that premise is a lot like the premise I got. And the fucked up thing about it was that the premise I do that's similar to Schumer's. I mean, you would never think that Amy Schumer and me would be similar, but it was actually a part of my my hour. That was a little bit of a departure for me. I was going to get a little dirty again. And I did, because I wanted to flex those muscles. But there was a similarity there. And it just hit me in the gut because of the day and age we live in now, all of a sudden it's sort of like, oh no, too similar. And it's really literally like maybe 30 seconds. It's just a premise, but it is a defined premise. It's not that unusual. It's not like it was necessarily an inventive thing. It's an observational piece of comedy, but it's a little crass. But as I said, didn't think either of us stole the joke or the premise. But I thought, well, what if people think that? And then that sort of weird fear comes in and you're like, what am I going to have to manage? What kind of shit's coming going to come at me for that? And Amy just went through some shit herself over stuff that was not true. And it's just the garbage culture we live in of talentless policing of people who do things as a means to sort of get traction and cause trouble, the troll culture. And it's diminishing and it's frightening. And like I had this moment where I'm like, I'm not going to fucking even record comedy anymore. I don't have to. I just do the podcast. I go perform my comedy, but I don't have to put it on tape to be scrutinized. Fuck it. It's not worth it anymore in troll garbage culture where people that do nothing but troll can hurt other people or try to destroy them. But that was the fear. That was the feeling. The way we used to handle it is the way I handled it. I watched her special. I texted her. I said, Amy, great special. It's really funny. But, you know, I got a bit that's a lot like one of your bits. And I just, you know, now I'm all panicky. And she texted back, hey, it's, you know, parallel thinking happens sometimes. They'll probably blame me. And I'm like, it's not about blame. I just feel shitty. And these things happen. But she's like, well, it's cool. We can talk about it next time I come on the show. Because I'd asked her to come back because she's one of these guests that had this tremendous success since I've talked to her. And I think I don't repeat guests, but I asked her to come back a couple of weeks ago. And I go, great. Okay, well, fun special. And then and that was that. So it was just never a thought. And you know, I mean, the fact is that it is what it is. Her special came out first. But in that moment, because of the world we live in now, it was like, ugh, fuck. What are the odds? What are the fucking odds? It's just what happens. We're all drawn from the same fucking reality. But it's not a good feeling. And it's sort of sad to me that my first thought was, you know, not she stole it or I stole it, which did not happen. But like, what's the point of putting comedy out there in the world in a recorded fashion for idiots to disassemble? It was just, I believed it. But again, if you're a little dirty, you talk a little dirty, you're probably going to talk dirty like somebody else who talks dirty. It's all funny. So right now, people, I'm excited for you to hear this. This is sort of an offbeat conversation for me. It's a little out of my wheelhouse, but I love this guy. I love the Aaron Draplin from Draplin Design Company, and he's a sweet guy. And we had a nice chat. So let's do this now. I did this in Portland a little while ago. We're walking and talking. So this is what is the title? What is the name of this operation?
The Draplin Design Company, Portland, Oregon.
Draplin Design Company, Portland, Oregon. This is the corner where the guitars are.
Right. This is my cockpit where I work and books and treasures and guitars and, you know, computers and things.
Look at those guitars, dude. You're a guitar player.
Well, that's a bit of a stretch. Yeah. I learn a song, I forget a song. Pretty simple.
But can you jam when necessary?
It's pretty much kind of by my lonesome.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, no, every now and again. Yeah, yeah.
That's how I roll. And that's a little Fender amp.
A little 54 Champ amp.
That's a real 54 Champ?
Yeah. When I made it, that's one of the first things I bought.
Was it real 54 Tweed Champ?
Yeah, it was a lot of money. You know, I splurged. And you could buy those reissues, but I went and bought, I got a real
one. No, I just got a 65.
I saw it.
And now we move over here. And this is where you have...
merch.
Mm-hmm.
All the shipping. This is where we do all the shipping.
Everything's done from here.
Well, not Field Notes. Field Notes is done out of Chicago. But here, all the Draplin Design stuff, pencils, trinkets, coin purses, beanies, hats, that's all shipped out of here.
Mm-hmm. And you don't live here.
No.
You live in a house.
I spend a lot of time.
Sure.
I live in a home. Yeah.
Let's walk over here. You got an anvil.
I have an anvil.
Just
been
a
restored.
That's a what?
Been restored.
Really? A restored anvil.
Mm-hmm.
And these are all the Field Notes and the, oh, look, here's some... some logos for things, for
we've
you.
Little cards to say thank you to people when we fill the orders.
Patches. Yeah.
Field notes, buttons, trinkets, combs. You got a good head of hair. Why don't you take a comb?
Yeah.
We call this the hair organizer.
I like it. It's a little comb. I don't know if it's going to work for me. Got the space shuttle.
Got T-shirts. Come over here. I'll show you where everything's. We keep all the stock.
Where?
So I have two partners here.
Yeah.
We have John Femister and David Nakamoto, and this is how we look out over Portland here.
Yeah.
We've been here about 6-7 years.
Right.
I work with these guys. We watch over each other, but we don't really like this. Me and this guy in the corner.
Yeah.
We made sure that we are as far apart diagonally as possible.
But he worked for you.
No. They work on their own projects. We just watch over each other, sort of financially.
Okay.
They have their projects. They work on a bunch of Giro helmets and shit. And then they have their side of the... So I have my side, and I move an inch a month right into their space.
Right. Slowly. And then one day you're going to be like, fellas, the time has come.
Oh, my God. If I hit it big, I'm going to forget those guys first. Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
right
yeah.
At the top of the list. Oh,
How'd
yeah.
you choose them to work
well,
with
Well, we
you?
All worked together at a little space in town here called Cinco Design.
Okay.
And we all jumped out, worked on our own out of our basements.
Mm-hmm.
And that got a little, I didn't have space. So we all came together to kind of watch, because there's strength in numbers. You know, the idea that we're sort of watching over each other's, you know, invoices and things. And then it's better to have eyes on all of our projects. So whatever I'm working on, Dave comes over and checks out.
So you trust these guys?
Oh, they're brothers of mine.
Right.
We've been together now 7 years in this shop, but been buddies since I got to Portland in, like, 2002.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So they're your guys.
Yeah.
All right, well, this is all very exciting, and a lot of boxes, a lot of merch, but this part of your operation, there's no reason for you to outsource the merch operation, because that's part of what you
do. Someone else gets the cut, then.
Let's go sit down, and where are we going to sit down and do this? In your corner?
Am I supposed to... Where's a spot where I say to you, why are you here? What is going on? Why am I freaked out?
Here's the thing, Aaron. I'll tell you why I'm here, and why you're here, and why we're both here. You come very well recommended by people that love you. You do a thing that is uniquely your own. You seem to be a character. You made a poster for me. I didn't know who you were, even though you accosted me at an airport in a very polite way, and you were a fan, and I remember that. But at that time, I had no idea, and I think you actually tweeted that you met me, and then people were like, "You guys gotta," and I'm like, "I don't know who that guy is."
Right.
And then I did a little research. I thought you were just one of these poster artist fellas who I've come in contact with.
Yeah.
But no, you run this small self-made empire of design and manufacturing. And people have a lot of respect for you. And I did a little research, and you seem to be an obsessive character that gets a lot of... Like when I watched that video of you going through your drawers, when you held up certain logos, it was as if you just took a hit of crack. Like that, you would say you would take a logo and you went, ooh,
yeah.
Like you had a thrill that it did something to your mind and heart.
Yeah,
that
it
there
does.
Was.
It does.
That's why I'm here.
Okay.
I'm
just a little freaked out, man. Because I listen to this stuff. I mean, it's been a number of years.
Well, don't judge yourself against any of the other interviews. They're all different.
There's some big ones, but this is where the podcast takes a slump and might need that after what you've been going through.
There's no slump involved.
Okay. I'm just setting it up, man. I don't want to let anyone down.
What you're doing is you're telling people to lower their expectations.
True.
You are an artist, and you are a man that's made something of himself. In a very specific world. You're wearing a hat that has your logo on it.
Oh, yeah.
That's not nothing.
I know. See, it gets bigger.
Yeah.
You know, this. What's so fun about this is when people, you know, say that, you know, how many people work for you? And it's me. You know, I do all the design, you know, from landing the job.
Yeah.
All the way up to settling all the invoices,
mm-hmm.
and you know, making the client happy. Now, in other situations, there's a lot of bureaucracy and hierarchy and things. That's any little design shop.
Mm-hmm.
I did that for a couple of years. And it wasn't necessarily it was bad. It just wasn't for me.
But let's go back.
Yeah.
Let's go back to how do people know you?
Well, probably through field notes.
Now, these are the books.
Yeah, these are little memo books that I make.
Now,
yeah.
Now let's...
We make a whole staff makes these things out of Chicago.
But this caught on.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
Okay. Well, I mean, I'm from Michigan, right? Mm-hmm. I'm from Michigan. And going all the way, you know, from Michigan to Portland and going junking, right? Antique malls, flea markets. You know, my dad there, that's, you know, he trained me. This is Jim Draplin.
Still around?
No.
Sorry.
About as dead as it gets. Oh, but still with us in every one of your molecules right now, Jim Draplin. This is the fucking, we can swear all we want
sure.
this thing,
yeah,
right?
Of course.
Sure, I know your deal.
Yeah.
Right. That was the Blue Light Special champion of participating Kmart stores in Northern Michigan. Right there. That's the guy, Jim Draplin, my dad, right? So growing up, we came, you know, Polish pack rat.
Uh-huh.
His joke was he always wanted one of everything.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Right? Okay.
Yeah.
And he taught us how to pull the vines back in Detroit, and we'd find these old signs.
Yeah.
Now, those old signs are worth $2,000 and $3,000.
So he's a junker.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So that quality of...
He sold the stuff?
No. He was an industrial tool salesman.
But he just collected.
Loved stuff.
Uh-huh.
He loved the tactile quality. He loved the little logo. He loved the charm. All of our furniture and stuff,
yeah,
that was stuff that he found dead in antiques, you know, antique stores.
What was his prize? Piece.
A roll top desk was one of the big ones. Some Coca-Cola stuff, maybe his children. He had three kids, one of each. That's what he'd say.
Right.
Yeah. And he was funny as shit.
Yeah. So you're driving with your pop going and he's showing you how to do stuff.
Well, you know, you'd see a garage sale sign.
Yeah.
And he'd start in on you and say, "Hey, this could be the one." What's it? It's 1987. I'm into skateboards.
Yeah.
He'd say, "This is the one with a box of skateboards." I said, "No." He'd say, "You never know."
Yeah.
And then we had to go. I never found shit all those years. But we went to all these things. He dragged my grandma, all of us. You know, I have all these funny stories, but that was planted in me. And then when I would drive out west as a youngster, I'd go junk, you know, because what do people do for fun on the road? I don't know.
You know?
And I would make the time. I'd find these little memo books. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking, have you ever been to a farm sale?
No.
Oh, it's the saddest thing in the world. People are rifling through things. You've been doing an estate sale.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Okay, well, when you go to like a little old lady who's selling off the farm and you're digging through her drawers and you find a stack from her husband of these memo books that he lived and died in, there's a lot of ghosts there. And that's where these little memo books came from. I would collect those things, hoard those things. I've got about 1,000 of them.
Filled
with people's handwriting and stuff. I mean,
what were they doing on the memo books? Was it just a coincidence that you found all these, or was this specific sale?
Yeah, it's sort of the currency of the agrarian landscape.
Okay.
Right? And these old timers always had this shit in their pockets, right?
So they would write what in it?
Lore, farm notes, seed stuff. You know, these were giveaways.
Right.
So all my life growing up, I always had something in my pocket. And I'd build my own books. I would make my own. I would,
How old are we talking?
Oh, God, since I can remember. I mean, I was, you know, I got a book deal, right? So I've been going through all my stuff. I have journals going back until I was about 12.
Really?
Yeah. And then I reread all the shit from when I left out west. Crying when you leave your mom and dad. I was 19 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I documented all that shit. I don't know what that was in me that was, you know, fearful mm-hmm. of not wanting to capture it.
Yeah.
I caught a lot of it, right?
Yeah.
So that idea of always having something to draw on at all times, I get fidgety when it's not right here.
Right.
You know, because not only is it about like, you know, collecting little, you know, last night your show, your ticket stub, Dean's little ticket stub was in there, you know, his little BMX sticker he gave me. It's a way to, you know, protect things, but any idea I have, That's where it goes. That's how the old timers did it for the last 100 years.
Well, that's how I used to do it. Like, I always had a notebook or a napkin. Like right now, I'm like, what if he says something and I got to bring it back around and I don't have a piece of paper with me? Can I have a field book?
Let me just, I'm going to put this down.
Yeah.
I'm going to change your life. Okay. Now everything is post, pre, post. Now it's time to get some field notes.
Okay.
Okay. What we're going to do is I'm going to give you a wood one.
This a wood? Cover.
These are cool.
Look at, oh, see that?
That's a piece of wood.
That's an actual piece of wood?
Yeah.
All right, so now...
Northern Wisconsin, they soak it overnight.
Yeah.
It gets sheared off.
Yeah.
They adhere it to basically brown paper bag.
Right.
That gets all, you know, stamped on, and then you can print on the stuff.
So this is like, I've seen these around, and this is you.
Yeah.
So this was inspired...
You with a big asterisk.
Mm-hmm.
Me and Jim Kudal, my mentor, my older brother, who, you know, I made a big stack of them here in town, because I couldn't find ones I liked. Everything you'd go see in some, okay.
Like a moleskin?
No, I don't use the M word around the shop.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, I'm with
But
you.
I saw those fuckers over in Italy. My first time I went there was for a client.
With the little band around.
And I bought like $500 worth because I never thought I'd go back to Italy, right?
But you loved them.
They were great. I used them for a couple years.
Yeah.
And then I made my own. It's just as simple as that. Right here in Portland. And then, you know, that first making, you know, I hand screen printed them, like your posters and shit. Mm-hmm. Like I hand did them. You know, you put staples and you cut the corners and all the stuff. Like I owned every little piece of it. Gave those to buddies. They ate them up a couple hundred.
Mm-hmm.
And then I made 2,000. Gave a stack to Jim Kudal out in Chicago.
Jim, what's he do?
Oh, what doesn't he do? I mean, he's just this incredible sort of entrepreneur, but sort of design,
a
little bit of web, an incredible website going 15 years now, of just incredible links and weird things. These are guys that figured out how to, you know, take your, remember your old Macintosh keyboards?
Mm-hmm.
They washed it in a dishwasher to get all the hair and shit. Because I'll tell you right now, if you go scrape that keyboard, you will get a wild assortment of shit.
Sure, man.
You could populate a whole city block with some of the...
It's like primordial soup.
I don't want to get into it.
Sure.
But remember how much hair and shit would be in those things? Yeah. They washed it. So they're just these really creative, weird kind of people.
What'd they do with them once they washed them?
Well, they just wanted to go test it. Mm-hmm. But they'd make these wonderful videos and have beautiful type, beautiful ideas. And, you know, it wasn't... You didn't have to sign up for this shit. So I was a fan of these little sort of like... you know, skits and things.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have clients, but they've never really talked about really what they do. Jim's whole mantra was basically, if a client doesn't teach us something, why are we going to be involved? Doesn't matter how much money you
make.
He's
a design firm.
Yeah. So, you know, Kudal Partners is what it's called. So I gave a stack to this guy who I was looking up to.
Right.
And he knew my shit. This is about 2005, 2004. And then next thing you know, we have a website. We have people interested. He's got all these tech people that he knows because he's a big keynote speaker at South by Southwest, all the tech side of things. And it explodes. And before you know it, you know, it's a real company.
Draplin Design.
It's a real deal. You can find them in men's stores. And when I go in those fucking men's stores, first thing I say with some numb nut behind the counter, I go, which way to the big and tall section?
Mm-hmm.
And you got this guy, who the fuck's got a 28-inch waist? I mean, really?
Yeah.
And I freak them all out and I'll just walk out. But they carry our field notes.
Yeah.
Places that sell $500 for pairs of jeans.
Yeah.
That's bullshit. I get my jeans at a little place in the U.S. outdoor store for $35.
Sure.
Like farmers.
But they carry a field note.
Oh, they carry our field notes.
Yeah.
We fill a lot of holes, I like to say.
Yeah.
In between all the expensive shit.
You know? Right.
Yeah.
So when did you, like, I understand your dad was a junker and he was a pack rat and he had an appreciation for it seems like there's a nostalgia to design.
Sure.
Not to design, but to your interest.
Yeah.
That it represents something that has integrity and that has staying power.
Simpler ways of making things.
Right, but it feels to me that when you see a logo, you're like, this stands the test of time.
Yeah.
Even if you don't remember what it was, you can take just the shell of it.
Well, yeah.
When did that start?
Well, I think since I was a little kid, you know, this idea of like, you know, when you get the first taste of California through BMX, skateboarding, you get to see things get like cool. You get to see things be manufactured somewhere and then sold to a bunch of peckerheads in Michigan. And everyone's got Ocean Pacific up and down. You know, you remember?
Sure, I remember OP.
Of course, I had the shorts.
Sure, okay? I had the shorts. I had the shirt. Had the, so, maybe the shoes.
Some kind of a hat or something.
I'm not a big hat guy. Okay, but yeah, well, maybe. But I remember OP was a big deal.
This idea that the first time you really start to recognize the power of a logo on a T-shirt, you know. And then you step back and you see how that's used around us in northern Michigan, which is basically on feed and seeds, like good old boys, you know, representing, I don't know, Arctic Cat snowmobiles and shit, you know, or representing wherever they go buy their feed and seed, right? Now, those, all those promotional items, those are things that were just giveaways to keep guys buying, you know, seed and shit.
Sure, but it was like, it's really it is a context of completely, the reality.
Completely lacking all sort of pretension. Mm-hmm. It was just to say, here's our stuff. Mm-hmm. So, okay, now I see skateboarding and art and culture and all the cool stuff, but I'm tempered around my dad, who's, you know, sells industrial tooling, where it is completely no bullshit. Mm-hmm. I mean, you talk about the tool.
Yeah.
Here's the graphic, and it works. Right. And the package is probably still in my dad's garage, right? Yeah, all these years later.
Yeah.
Now, that kind of functionality, that's not what existed when I finally got my shot to go learn how to be a graphic designer.
Right.
It was about fashion. It was about what's the latest, hottest, bullshittest thing, you know, right? Right, right, right.
No integrity.
Well, no. It just, because I wouldn't throw all those guys, what do you call, under the bus. No, it's more like I just like things that my dad could enjoy.
Yeah.
And I was into. Because there's always a leap from us to like your parents, and they didn't understand all this highfalutin postmodern bullshit, right?
Right. But there's something about their generation, there's something about even the idea of an industrial tool where it's sort of like you're going to buy one of these.
Yeah.
And it's going to last
works.
You. And
you it have to works. Save for it. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's, you know, you can pass that on to your kid. Yeah. So what you got passed down was this compulsive fascination and belief in the long-lasting nature of something that is built to work, perhaps.
Yeah. Well, and what you see is you just see this beauty to it. Because listen, when I have to think about it, then it's designed.
Yeah.
Now these guys, they weren't designing to be ironic,
right?
To be cool, to sell shit, to sell jeans, to sell this, to sell records, any of this kind of stuff. It was just meant to work. That is what I try to mine from my work. This beautiful quality of undesignedness. I don't know what you even call it.
What are some of your favorites? Like, do you like the Levi's tag?
Oh, yeah.
Right?
It goes back 115, 120 years.
Love that, right?
I just like things that are iconic and didn't get fucked with, right?
What was the first one when you were a kid where you were like, that's fucking...
Bicentennial logo? I can remember. I was telling you last night. I can remember that all the way back because there was this geometry.
You have it tattooed on your calf.
Oh, you should have seen me laying there.
Yeah.
Not good.
Yeah.
You a tattoo guy?
No.
I got a couple.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's
you
all
very... You have the Bicentennial one.
Yeah, it's very out of... Well, that's my favorite logo, you know? And I remember, you know, my dad explained to me, you know, 10 rings, 20 years a ring, 200 years worth of 200... I was tiny. Then you see it on the space shuttle, and then it goes away. And it's gone.
But what I think what fascinated you was there was a whole code to it that it had to be demystified. Everything had a reason that behind the
design. We used to celebrate America.
Yeah.
We used to celebrate it.
Sure.
I mean, 1776. Yeah. You know, what is it? Carter? You know, they're coming off of Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's cynical. I was three. I don't know. But it was like, here's this 200-year thing. And it was a big nationwide party. And one designer... Bruce Blackburn, with these Chermayoff guys and our guys, whatever, out of New York City, they build this mark that represents America. Like, what do we have when we go across wherever?
Mm-hmm.
When you go to Canada, their flag is incredible. I mean, I love our American flag, but this logo signified for me growing up America, but it was gone. You know, all through the, you know, I don't know. After I saw it in the space shuttle, the next time I saw it was on the guitar of one of the Mercury Rev guys.
Uh-huh.
You know, I was like, what the hell was that? And then, you know, yeah, you remember those guys?
Yeah.
Fucking, I got all the records.
Yeah.
But I saw it there. I went and started looking because that's when I was really getting into, you know, well, design, what about 91, 92, you know, and found it and then found Paul Rand and Saul Bass. These are the fucking pillars of logo design. But like Lowry Salt, Bell Telephone, AT&T, the classics from 1960s and shit. And that thing still works in 2015. So this is, 25 years ago, my first sort of inkling of this stuff was like, wow, these are things that you find at, like, garage sales. They're junk. But that logo's great. It still works. Mm-hmm. See what I'm saying?
I did.
Now, and then I was being dipped in the wildness of the 90s. Ray Gun.
When you're growing up, you mean?
Yeah, like, you know, all the cool things. You know, guys set in fucking, remember Reagan magazine? You know,
where they had,
you know, Damage this and David Carson's and stuff, this stuff.
Was that Gary Panther?
No, he was a cool name though, right?
He was in the Raw.
I used to have a dog named Gary.
Right? Yeah.
You ever met a dog named Gary?
No, I meet less and less Garys now. Gary's out.
That name's gone its way out, man.
Yeah, it didn't hold up like the AT&T logo.
I have theories about that shit. Gary, Barry, Larry. These names just kind of make you shudder.
Sure. Well, there's
Harry.
I don't think there's a lot of gyms around anymore.
There's not a lot of gyms.
Yeah, it's just like
I just met a kid named Frank on my tour.
Good. Thank
Frank,
God. There's a
he's
few
about
Franks.
25 sure. years old. Like now, everyone's named. Cute names.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. Jesse.
Ethan. Yeah, shit, Ethan, smart names.
And other like Buffalo, maybe.
Twig and shit. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. All right, so young Aaron James Draplin.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Is starting to realize like these logos represent things that are bigger than us. There's almost a mystical, spiritual element to them.
Well, no, I think what
come
I liked
on.
About
it.
No. Was okay. that it was corporate, and there's a big word. Because remember, you know,
in America though, that represents spiritual, mystical.
Well, sure, fucking hey. Right? Well, yeah. there, you know, in those '90s, where you know you have a Nirvana come and just shake everything.
Yeah,
that's the year I got out of high school. So that's starting that fall. I'm starting college.
Yeah,
Nevermind hits. So what do we have just a year before that? Hair metal.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Now, we didn't have that. We were raised on punk rock.
You were.
And, oh yeah. You know, my mom raised us on. Well, Joni Mitchell's, Neil Young's, but she had the MC5 record with the motherfucker on the inside.
With no irony to it, with no, like, she got it when it came
them.
Out.
My mom went and saw the Stooges, she went and saw the MC5, Bobby Seger. This is what we come from.
You grew up in Detroit?
I was born in Detroit.
But she grew up in Detroit.
Yeah, mom and dad were Detroit kids. Mom was Livonia, and dad was Detroit, Dearborn, and my Polish grandmother. You know, it was just, these are incredible people. My Irish grandmother, you know, out in Wixom and all this bullshit, you know, away from Detroit. And then my grandma, who was one of the last holdouts in her little neighborhood, this whole Polish lady.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad would go down every other week. So he would be down there for a week and work. And then we would go down for summers. So we spent a lot of time in Detroit.
Pierogies?
Oh, yeah. Come on. Yeah. Put a hurt on that shit. Polish kitchen down in Hamtramck? Sure.
Yeah. That's what you're brought up on.
Yeah. I'm half Polish. It's debatable what parts.
Sure.
But half. And, you know, we had that, you know, I don't know. It's like, I have a weird, talk about mysticism. Like, I have a weird quality about Detroit because that's where I'm from, you know. Going back.
You were born there.
Well, yeah. You know, but it's like then 4 years old, we go up to northern Michigan, middle of nowhere, because mom and dad couldn't take it because it was rough. You know, my dad would tell stories about painting and looking across the city and seeing the smoke burn from the riots.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they grew up around. That's 4 miles or 5 miles down Woodward or wherever, right?
Yeah.
You know, imagine growing up and having that shit going down just a couple miles away.
Right.
You know, and these weird dividing lines, they got out of there. So we were four, we moved to, you know, northern Michigan. So I grew up in a town where I had 30 kids in my class.
Small.
Tiny.
But your mom had Neil Young.
Yeah.
MC5. So the MC5 blew your, how old, your five-year-old mind, six-year-old mind?
I would have, no, I wouldn't have heard that. I would have been hearing a lot of Jackson Browne shit during those years.
Yeah.
You know, but the idea that I would, you know, I heard it when I was about 15.
Oh.
Because, you know, I found punk rock.
Yeah.
And she went and dug this thing out.
She's like,
and she explained to me, this says motherfucker on the inside, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, I just have to say it, you know. My parents are cool.
Yeah.
I had cool, listen, I listened to your shit.
Yeah.
Last summer, you know, after we lost Pops, you know, and listened to you, that we were driving home.
Yeah.
I lost my shit. Listen, you lose your shit with your dad.
Mm.
I know that people come up to you and tell you this stuff. So I'm kind of freaking out right now because that's how I know you.
Yeah.
These weird connections, you know. And I talk about my dad. I kind of lose it, but I'm not going to be a fucking professional for this. But I was raised, we didn't have any beefs, you know?
Yeah.
Like, maybe we used to fight. He used to want me to mow the fucking lawn diagonally.
Yeah.
And then he'd do it the other way, like Tiger Stadium. Right. We'd fight over that shit.
Not horizontal.
I wasn't going to do it like that.
Not horizontal.
That's the height of our brawls. So I had this mom and dad who were liberal and cool, and it was never, ever about don't drink and don't fight and don't whatever. You know, they told us, they guided us.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm a teetotaler
to
this day, pretty much. Every now and again, I lose my shit.
Right.
But I was raised around that. You know, they were cool. You know, everything that we had, we sort of, my dad would find, like, all the molding in our house.
Yeah.
He dug that shit out of, like, old crack houses in Detroit and stuff. That's what I was raised around, seeing piece by piece. Because I never really knew that they didn't have a lot. There's some rough winters there.
Yeah.
I just never really knew because we had, you know, love and Legos and art shit and mom and dad around.
What'd your mom do?
Raised us.
Uh-huh.
But she's she would for a couple of years there, she was doing some sort of like, I mean, she raised us.
Yeah.
You know, it was in a small town. You know, me and my sister.
But Sarah, no painters or no, you know.
A little bit of basket weaving.
Oh, yeah.
But creative.
Yeah,
you know, creative. Right, creative. These are creative people.
Right.
And then also, you know, like collectors.
Uh-huh.
So all this, you know, we had all this cool stuff. Like, they had an eye for these things. Before us, that's what our house was outfitted with. Old stained glass and all sorts of little figurines and shit that's, you know, what, 30, 40 years later is worth a lot of cash.
Yeah.
And my parents, that's what they did for fun before us. See, they waited to have us until they were 30.
Uh-huh.
That was kind of unheard of back then.
Yeah.
You know, you're supposed to be 20 when you have a kid, right?
Right,
back in 1970 or whatever. But they waited, and then my dad used to get himself fired from his steelworker job so he can go skiing in Vail. Jim Draplin.
Yeah.
My dad claimed that for one quarter, he'd get his arm up in the fucking vending machine and empty the whole goddamn thing and feed all the dudes, right?
Yeah.
Until he got his arm caught one time. That was one of his great stories. So I was raised around this, like, fight for the little guy.
Yeah.
Before you take the big hook.
Yeah.
Deal with all the little hooks. Don't buy anything you can't afford. This kind of shit.
Yeah.
That's what we were raised around. You know, so I had great examples of that stuff. And then my dad going ape shit. You know, and just kind of going, let's just get one. You want it? Let's buy it.
Yeah.
Don't tell your mom. Skateboard decks, records, things.
Yeah.
And then, you know, with my mom, great memories. I'm, you know, making the book, mm-hmm. and I'm finding little things that I have, and I found a receipt for my mom taking me to this little town and buying me pads for my BMX bike,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
I remember this. I was like 8 or 9. I'll never get rid of that. So is that nostalgic? Or do I even need that paper? Fuck it. I got room.
Yeah.
I'm going to keep it. You know what I mean? I just found it. Why do I even have that?
Yeah.
So we were, because now when we lost dad, you know, my dad used to call me. He'd say, Aaron, I'm in the garage. Guess what I found? I'd say, what's that, dad? And he'd say, I found a wall.
A wall?
Yeah, I get it. You're the guy who writes comedy. It's fucking funny. He found a wall. So we're tearing apart my dad's empire, you know, and one by one, all these pieces, there's stuff that has value. There's things that he collected. Toucans, or what do you call them? Like a parrot?
Yeah.
You know, or something. He just liked stuffed parrots.
He's
40 of the fucking things.
Yeah.
But he just loved ephemera and things and bric-a-brac. So you see how I, you know, this is where I come from. Remember how some dads were like.
Is that a deluxe?
No. That's a new bass amp. A new Fender bass amp.
Okay.
I saw the Meat Puppets play last summer, and that's what he was playing.
He got one.
Yeah, I got one. I couldn't take it. So, you know, I made it, man. I can buy what I want.
It's a new tweed,
Yeah.
All right, so your dad, this is how this influenced your life.
Yeah. You know, just this idea of like having an appreciation for all the little tiny stuff. Now we can't get rid of it because we have this big house full of it.
Yeah.
You know, when someone goes, you know.
Your dad's stuff.
Yeah.
You
know, my mom. See, this is a very interesting thing growing up.
Yeah.
That, you know, that which comes from the sea eventually goes back to it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So my dad would be smuggling shit in, and then my mom would just go cherry pick shit every week and go take it back. And here's this idea of my dad at some junk store, because he had a whole network in northern Michigan. He had some junk store going, this is pretty cool. He already bought it, and she gave it back, and it's just back in the cycle. You know, that must have happened. And this is what we grew up around. So, you know.
So when does design start to happen? So, I mean, you sound like you were involved in the BMX thing and skateboarding. So you did pools and stuff?
No. That's a little bit before us. You know, this is just out in front of our house in a little shitty, you know.
But you weren't like that guy.
No.
Skating the bowls.
No. I did a couple out west when I was of age, when I finally got out there. But, you know, you're in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
And you're seeing the magazines from all these cool Californias, and that shit's on your wall.
Yeah.
And you start thinking and saving and getting the hell out. Like, you know, right out of high school, I was 17. I got out a little early, you know, so I'm a senior, whatever. I went through the whole deal. But I'm an October kid, so I was a little young for it. And I got out, and I started college. I did 2 years to placate my mom and dad, because I'm one of the first draplings who actually went to school,
uh-huh.
You know? And I remember just them saying, go. It was community college. Just go, because we didn't get a chance to. So I did. All my buddies were moving out west, and I had
to
the
do
itch.
What?
Snowboard.
Okay. I didn't.
Because there's no mountains, you know? Yeah. So we're going to go out there to be skateboarders and snowboarders. And animals.
That was the future.
Well, this is what we did growing up on really limited sort of conditions and height and vertical, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Tiny little molehills. Mm-hmm. It's Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
You know how you make a hill in Michigan? You dig a hole and then you put it like this, and that makes a nice hill, right?
Yeah,
I mean, that's
okay.
Michigan.
Yeah.
So we've been watching, we're watching, and then we get the hell out of there. So I was 19 when I moved out west.
Yeah.
And that would have been 93. And, you know,
after college, what did you study at community
just
college?
Just a tiny little 2-year associate degree.
In what?
But I learned design. I learned how to like open the machine, open the programs, play with them, make stuff, draw, paint. Just a nice overview in Northern Michigan. So I got that little bit out of the way, and then I had their blessing. And as soon as I turned 19, 2 years done, that's when we took off. We saved all our money washing dishes.
Who's we?
Me and my buddies.
Yeah.
Bry and Derek and Chad and Johnny, about 6-7 of us, all Eric Campbell. We all went out west together.
Yeah.
You know, my crowning achievement from my youth is leaving. Sucked. Tears. It's freaky. But the moment you get away from your mom and dad, your life explodes, you know, and you go all the way out west, all the way to Oregon. We kind of, you know, jumped over, leapfrog over fucking Colorado because all of our buddies were already there. Because, you know, this shit shifts, you know. 1 year it's Jackson Hole that where all the kids are going.
For snowboarding.
Yeah. Any of the skiing and all this kind of bullshit. Yeah. All, you know, skiing sucks.
Right.
I know you do a little skiing. There's still time for you. But
I tried snowboarding. It's hard to.
Oh, come on, man. We invented it.
Yeah.
I'm so proud of that.
You invented it?
Well, we just got fucked with. Because what was cool at the time, assholes testing each other and like getting times and medals and shit and like expensive ski gear.
Yeah.
And suddenly, see, this is what skateboarding and snowboarding taught me. Like, it was okay to be with your buddies.
Yeah.
And to be big or weird or buddies with drug problems, buddies. But it also got me into punk rock and art and thinking for yourself. That fucking rescued me because in my small town.
And that comes from snowboarding. And
it just came from, it just came from sort of being, you know, kind of punk rock.
Yeah, fuck the old paradigm.
Well, just in that small town, if you're not in sports, you're not nothing. I tried.
Yeah.
But fuck all that. It took a lot of guts to say no to it.
Yeah.
Because I had guys messing with me.
Right.
I had a big dead Kenny's in the back of my cutoff jean jacket.
Yeah.
I mean, I did that and I got messed with for it.
Yeah.
But it teaches you to be your own person.
So y'all
I'm so thankful for that.
Sure.
That's where I discovered indie rock. Yeah. Sebadoh's and shit.
Right.
92.
Right.
Red House Painters. I brought my 20 best records today. I'm going to pull them out.
You brought them with you?
Yeah. I don't even know if I even want you even touching them.
I won't touch them. You can hold
mint.
Them up. Mint.
Mint. A little bit of ring wear in there.
Sure.
This is, okay, Kill Creek, Proving Winter Cruel.
Don't
this,
even know what that
okay.
record is.
You know, okay. This got me through a whole summer up in Alaska. This one
Kill
record,
Creek.
Okay. This is a very rare record. Okay.
Stick
my favorite sure. Stones record,
yep.
just because. Okay,
absolutely.
My favorite Bob Seger record, Brand New Morning. This is the one that he says is always buried in people's backyards because you can't fucking find it.
I don't know this record.
This is when he was on Capitol. This is before he exploded. See, it's not cool to like Bob Seger where I'm from, right?
Because Michigan. He come from there, though.
Right. But then you realize your uncles were onto something, man, because Bob Seger.
You can't find that. I've never seen that record.
Very hard to find, okay? Paw Dragline. As grunge was exploding, this was they were putting their big money on this one. This is a great fucking
don't,
record.
I've never seen it before
okay,
in my life.
Okay, you're not even allowed to touch this. Don't
that
even,
I know.
I don't even like even fucking looking at it. It's still sealed. It's mint, OOP, the classic Flamin' Lips fucking transmissions from the satellite heart.
Yeah,
it, I don't even like. Don't even look at it. God damn
okay,
it.
Okay, fine.
Here is that
I
MC5.
Got that one. Couple
okay,
of those.
Okay, okay.
Sure.
It's got the motherfucker on the inside.
Yep.
Just so you know,
yep.
for the listeners here, my very very famous favorite. Red House Painters record. The Jesus Lizard. You didn't get into the Jesus.
No, dude.
I'm going to make you a list while you're here. I'm going to rescue you.
No,
I should go through all your records and
no,
just
it's all right.
edit out the
it,
show.
I'm
okay,
taking
God
it
damn
in.
It. Every time that you have someone on talking about vinyl, I always want to hear, what are their favorite records, man? What are they? What's their favorite shit? But you guys are talking about, you know, everything else.
I'll make note of that, Aaron. I'll make note of that.
All right.
Thank you for the note. But all right, so, okay, so you go out, you got your 2 years of design, and you're going to snowboard and skateboard your way to freedom.
Yeah.
And Colorado was done, so you end up in Portland.
Go all the way to Oregon, to Bend, Oregon, about 3 hours from here.
Right.
And that first day you're there, you know, there's a hill, but it's going to open up in two months, but we have all our cash.
Yeah.
We lock down a place,
yeah.
you know, and then that first night, we run up to Portland. Now listen, growing up in Detroit, you get your car stolen. Right? It's like dangerous and shit.
Right, yeah.
Or there's this sort of like shit hanging over you from like your uncles. Be careful where you're going downtown or whatever, right? So we go see all these, you know, bands growing up, and it was kind of sketchy.
Right.
You come to Portland, you can park, you can walk across town, you can hang out. The first night we get here, we see this band called Paw. It's an old band from Kansas, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we had listened to their record all the way across the nation, okay? Now, it could have been any other record, but that first night we come to Portland, it was just like, fuck, man, my life is starting.
Mm-hmm.
2 months from now, we're going to be up one of the greatest mountains in the world, Mount Bachelor, you know, being animals, being with my buddies. We're young, we're wild. And Portland is like, I don't know, it was like approachable. Mm-hmm. So we start coming up here every other weekend to see bands and stuff at La Luna. So that would have been 93, the fall of 93.
Uh-huh.
And then as soon as the snow hit, you know, we were up there every single day being snowboarders. You know,
yeah.
It was incredible. And you get this orbit, you know, and you're at the height of sort of your physicality, too. You're jumping off pretty big shit because what we were doing back home was just smaller.
Right.
And you get out west, and I had buddies who were becoming pros. I was never really concerned about any of that.
Yeah.
I just got to hang with those guys.
Yeah.
And we realized all of our dreams over the course of about five winters, you know. But, you know, I worked at a snowboard camp up here. You know, one summer I was the only kid that was like a teetotaler. So I drove the hospital van. Kids would fuck themselves up, and I'd drive them down to Portland. Yeah. I'd drop them off at this little urgent care.
Right.
I'd go to the record store.
Because
that's all, you know. So I started doing that. I started going to Alaska to wash
dishes.
What
were you doing for a job?
Well, for those first couple of years, I had pizza jobs.
Yeah.
And then I was doing freelance art. So it was all analog. I was painting, drawing stuff, making logos, snowboard graphics for like local, small change things in Bend. But really, whatever it took. But then I started going to Alaska because I needed a computer. So that was the summer of 96. And I go up there and I wash dishes for like 100 hours a week.
Where?
For 5 months. Anchorage.
Yeah.
On sightseeing train.
Couple years in Anchorage I spent.
Really?
Sure.
What years?
My dad was stationed up there.
When you were like small.
Yeah, 69 through 71. 70, 71.
What an incredible place.
I don't have, my recollections are limited to tone.
Right.
And a few weird moments. But I love it. It planted a seed in me. Like I'm still very compelled by the Pacific Northwest because of the expanse.
My first summer up there, listen, I wasn't, there's nothing worse than happy hikers. Okay, you know what I'm talking about. Nalgene bottles, like those stupid pants that you zip down to shorts and all this kind of shit. There was one little record store in town. That was my only splurge. That summer I saved 10 grand.
In Anchorage.
That's how I got a computer, right?
Yeah.
That's how I got access to design.
Yeah.
But you're up there and everyone's partying down and going apeshit. And, you know, it just wasn't very like, I just remember one of the guys, one of the cooks saying, I know you want to go home. You're excited to go start your fall and get my computer at the end of the summer.
Right.
He said, but just so you know, Alaska's in you now. It's real poetic. And I kind of freaked out on him. Said, "Oh man, this is just a summer job because that's really all it was."
Yeah.
But I got to tell you, man, I got the itch next spring just to be around that place, and mainly because it didn't get hot. It was beautiful. There's a good record store, and I worked a ton. You know, so that started basically being my way to pay for college, pay off credit cards, get ready for snowboard passes, whatever to come back for. You know, and then when I got myself into school in Minneapolis, that's how I kind of got myself in, was with that cash.
So you're doing some local illustrating. You're making a little money. What they pay you for the art.
Yep.
And it goes on a sign or it goes on an ad.
I was lettering futon covers. You know, I was painting futon covers for a local place there. I was lettering a chalkboard. I would go and they'd give me a menu and I could, put their shit.
What, daily?
Once a week, and I'd take as much bread as I wanted back to the house, and we'd live off this shit, me and all my guys,
Right.
And you don't need a lot. There were six of us in a house or something, and your share is $117 a month. So you can make that in a cut, whatever, And, you got to pass up at the hill, so really, what do you need? We hitchhike up to the hill, we're all sort of eating communally, or whatever. It was 5 winners that were really, really cool.
At what point did you think maybe I need to make a life for myself?
Well, I think it was just seeing other guys do it, make these leaps, other guys that were allowed to go to school and get big, degrees and stuff. Guys that would come up and work for snowboard companies. We started going to all these big trade shows.
Right.
So you make this
just
leap.
Just to see the shit.
Well, you got to see the shit and see all the pros.
Yeah.
And then you also realize how small it is.
Right.
The moment that you find out, how small your favorite band is or the politic.
Yeah.
You grow up. And I don't even want to know anymore because at 41 years old, it hurts to hear these things.
Mm-hmm.
So we go down and we see these, all the companies. I was 19, 20 years old. Talk about pool skating. We got, you ever heard of the Nude Bowl out in California?
No.
Okay. Well, this is one of the classics. Skateboarders listening to this shit would understand. And listen, I caught one grind that day in the Nude Bowl. Scared the shit out of me. This is the real deal.
What does it mean, caught a grind?
I just went up, I was just carving and then come down, And as a man of size, I was with guys that knew what the fuck they were doing.
Yeah.
But I caught one grind in the Nude Bowl, and that's where I was like, I've reached my, the pinnacle of doing this stuff. I grew up doing it, but until you slam, in a ditch in Las Vegas, going fast in these little banks, and my elbow still hurts to this day.
Yeah.
Now, that's where you sort of realize I was kind of done.
Yeah.
I was about 97.
Okay.
So it was basically, it wasn't really fun to snowboard anymore.
Why?
Because it just became an orbit.
Yeah.
I learned the hill.
Right.
And I saw buddies becoming professionals. Great.
Yeah.
But I was drawing. I had my computer from Alaska, and I'm working. But in that small town, you're seeing there's like a couple guys that have it.
Yeah.
And I don't want to go and fight those guys. You know what I mean? Like, being a pecking order. I knew I was at the very, very bottom. They let you know.
Right.
So I just kind of tried to go a little bit above it. Went to a couple more summers in Alaska, a couple more winters, kept laid low. I worked a ton on my own. It was all just for my buddies, freelance, Funlance, just really just learning, right? But I started looking
at school. Were you doing gig posters?
Just for a couple buddies.
Yeah.
No, I just didn't know bands.
Right.
We'd come up and see all the shit here in Portland.
Right.
Now we'd come up here and groups of guys would go see some goddamn fucking Offspring or something. Yeah. I'd be going to see the Jesus Lizard.
Right.
I mean, the good stuff.
Yeah.
I'm so thankful, man. Because you got to make a choice.
Yeah.
Are we going to see goddamn Girls Against Boys today? We are. We're going to see them at a crusty little place. Or are we going to see the Lemonheads? I kind of saw that stuff too. But we knew how to find the weird shit.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And Portland offered it. So I'm told you got to go to school.
Mm-hmm.
So I go back to the Midwest because I got to get out of the West.
You love the Midwest?
I love it.
Yeah.
But I didn't. I loved leaving it.
Right.
And you go back there and you see all this shit going on. And I went to little schools and so I didn't know what I had. I had a portfolio, but it was all just from a very organic, just shit made. I made shit for my buddies.
Yeah.
So I show all this work and I'm thinking they're going to say, get the hell out of here. And the first school said, we can't have you here because we want you to go up the food chain a little bit. So I just was like, ooh. So then I went to some other school, and I made my way up to this incredible school in Minneapolis, and they were the nicest people. And Minneapolis was the home of the Replacements.
Right.
And the Husker Du's.
Yeah.
And then Chuck Anderson's, Charles Spencer, my favorite graphic designer of all time from the CSA Empire, Charles Spencer Anderson.
What's his thing?
It's big archive, incredible detail. My dad could enjoy their work, French paper company was one of those out of Niles, Michigan. Six generations of paper, French paper company.
Yeah.
Incredible people, Niles, Michigan.
What was their logos?
There's so much.
Oh,
I mean,
really?
I can show you books upon books. But what Chuck did was he would go find all that dead, advertising art and stuff, and would clean that stuff up and rescue it. And, and then you could go buy it from an archive. So someone could buy that old stock stuff because some old guy would die and then his work would die with it.
Well, how do you use it? What do you mean? What are you rescuing?
He would rescue sort of like something you might find on like a matchbook cover or something.
Mm-hmm.
So then Chuck would go hunt down the old illustrator, find a wealth of this stuff, buy the collection, clean it all up.
Clean it up how?
Computers and stuff.
Okay.
Scan it, clean it, but put it into a nice little book. I could show you the books. I got the whole mess.
As a resource.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right? So I'm seeing this guy. Now, what was cool in 1995, 96, 97? It was all that skittery, scrattery bullshit sort of. Sorry about the train, man.
It's okay,
sorry.
Man.
Okay.
Texture.
all that, postmodern, very highfalutin graphic design.
Yeah.
I was trying to emulate it too until I found these guys in Minneapolis that were like, I don't know. It was sort of like I said, my dad could enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
I could look at it.
Yeah.
Because it looked like, sometimes it looked just like something that you found out of an old Popular Mechanics.
Sure.
Like your poster.
Love the poster.
Because that was just meant to be just sort of an homage to shit that you find in a dumpster.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. There's no design. It's just meant to be stupid and then make funny copy for it. So that's what these guys did. And I discovered these guys out of Delaware called House Industries. That you might be familiar with those guys. You should be. House Industries.
That.
But they did all sorts of typefaces. But what they did, House Industries and Chuck did for me, they made design look fun.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
And somehow those guys made a living. All these 20 years later, I've been able to meet them and shit. Chuck's a bit of a mentor. I know the guys at House. We fuck with each other on Twitters and things. I send them stuff. They send me stuff. And, I went and knocked on the door because I was doing fall tours just by myself, driving around. Because I'd go home. I was in a minivan, road tripping back and forth.
Is after mom and college, dad. After Minneapolis?
Just every couple times a year. And I'd drive back and forth, and I'd go junk. But then when I leave the West, I went and hit, I went to Delaware. I'd never been to Delaware. And I knocked on the doors of House Industries. And I have them built up in my mind as this big fucking thing.
Sure.
And the guy answers the door, and he's kind of surprised. And we're still buddies to this day. They let me in. But see,
Well, what was it like? Was it disappointing? Were you surprised?
No, it was like six or seven guys, but it was the best work in the world. It was the power of design, right? Yeah,
right.
What I knew of it as a fan attracted me all the way to this little place in Delaware.
Right.
And then they were cool on top of that, okay?
Yeah.
Because listen, I'm not gonna name any fucking names, but I did that with other guys I was into, and they weren't cool.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
So when you start to stack up the dicks from the good guys, there was a certain design sense to the good guys.
Yeah.
And that's what really changed me.
Yeah.
And because it wasn't about who was the most fashionable. It was about the guys that were, it wasn't necessarily just about being fun. It was just, there was a certain charm.
Uh-huh.
And they still did the job, uh-huh. You know?
So, and you liked the work. I got to assume there's not a lot of kids that show up going like, I love you guys.
Well, they freaked out. Yeah. Because it's somewhere in their fucking, yeah, you know, yeah, some of the materials it said, show up. So I did.
Right.
You know? And that's what happens to me now, man.
Oh, they come?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And yeah. I make sure they're not, I'm sure it happens to you, right? You know?
Yeah.
But, you know, make sure
they come
not
to my house.
Axe murderers or whatever.
Well, you know, it's hard to tell sometimes. But we're okay.
I've had a couple guys come in here that were a little mm-hmm. off.
Yeah.
But I was real gentle and just had to kind of say, hey, you got to go, man.
Yeah.
That scared me, too.
Yeah.
Because those guys let me in. And I try to make the same thing now when there's the, you know, the role.
But you
reversed.
Felt that they were dangerous or just a little too much?
Well, these guys who came to my shop, yeah, here, they were just a little off.
Yeah.
You know,
you could
tell
feel
them
it.
It's time to go.
What are they looking for? Why'd they come in?
Well, they're fans for my website or whatever, yeah, or the way I write or the way I talk or the way that I would write them back.
Mm-hmm.
I've written all the kids back, man.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, it happens.
I know people always say there's no time for that shit.
Right.
But I made the time all these years, you know? Try
so, okay, so you go to the college in Minneapolis.
Yeah.
And now, you know, you got more confidence.
Yeah.
You find maybe you got a little style happening of your own.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
it was
then,
also a reaction against what was cool at the time too, you know?
Yeah.
See, I go back to Minneapolis and it was a lot, talk about style. Man, kids were getting jobs with, dripping whatever the latest bullshit was.
Yeah.
But I wasn't really into that skittery, scrattery. Remember the movie Seven?
Yeah.
In the start of the movie,
sure,
it's like,
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah.
That's what was in high fashion.
Right, right, right.
So kids
not
were
your
learning,
thing, not your
well,
thing.
Well, they were learning how to do it. I couldn't learn how to do it. I liked the grid. I liked logos. I liked old maps.
Yeah.
That you still worked. Mm. I liked things that worked 40 years ago and still worked.
Yeah.
And that might be the roll of toilet paper. So see, you know, you got to put it like a, you know, you got to tell you what diameter it is and how many more rolls are left. That's called being a tradesman, right?
Right.
So I wasn't trying to go be the hottest shit in town. I want to get a job. I got made fun of by a teacher because when
at
you're doing
Minneapolis,
when you're doing one of your reviews, yeah, and it was like, well, what do you want to do with this, with what you got going? You know, and I said, I want to go make a living. And that wasn't a big enough answer. And it was total bullshit. I was scared. I had loans. I had things, I had stuff. I paid for myself to go. I got a big scholarship somehow from these guys, which was incredible, but it was very pragmatic.
Right.
I'm learning a skill set, and I'm going to go get a job. And wherever I land, I'm going to be good with it because it beats fucking washing dishes in Alaska.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
That's not what they train you for. They train you to go to the – everyone's, you know, measuring dicks trying to get to the coolest place in town, which was called the Walker Art Center, which is incredible. I got to do my talk at the Walker Art Center, right? That's the coolest thing in all of Minnesota. But one or two kids got to go there, you know, and work and, you know, get the big job.
Mm-hmm.
98 or 99 of the 100, they went and had jobs at 3M and Cabela's and just regular things.
In-house.
Target, whatever you want to get. Just regular jobs. I was okay with that.
You like the 3M logo?
Oh, yeah. It's a classic. I mean, I got made fun of that. I got made fun of for that shit.
Yeah.
You know? Because it wasn't – you're supposed to go work in L.A. or New York.
Be part of the what's happening now crew.
I was excited to stay in Minneapolis. And then I threw it all away and went to fucking Southern California.
Well, how'd that go? You're going for a job?
Yeah, Snowboarding Magazine.
You got hired?
I got hired.
To do what?
Well, a bunch of guys I met from camp.
Yeah.
From summer 95.
Yeah.
This is about 2000.
Right.
So I'm getting done with school.
Mm-hmm.
And I got courted to go have a real job. And then I get this little hook. Fucking San Clemente, Orange County is the worst.
Sure.
But it was the mag I read growing up, and I couldn't say no. So I took this job. I go all the way down to California, throw my life away in the Midwest, and I'm immersed back in snowboarding, right?
What are you doing? What's your job?
Art director for a snowboard magazine,
okay,
laying out magazines.
Yeah.
You know? So I got a stack over there of about 25 mags from that 2 years I was there, and I got to work with all my buddies at snowboarding. And it was, you know, you get there, and it's supposed to be this big professional job, but you realize it's just seven or eight of us. Like a group, like a little gang, because in that hierarchy of where even the building we're in,
yeah,
surfing's the hot shit.
Right.
I don't step in the ocean. I'm from Lake Michigan.
Right.
Okay. I don't do very well on a beach.
Yeah.
Okay. Fucking, they're the cool guys, and we're the scumbags snowboarders. So there's like a chip on your shoulder, and you know, you get to come in and you learn how to make a magazine, which is about a month long.
Did you learn how to do that? You didn't have any idea.
Well, I had a little bit of idea of like just sort of publication design, but then you get there and it's page by page. So I learned how to churn out a lot of stuff and fast and be efficient, work well with all my buddies, still be the dark cloud that I was, and you know, constantly challenging myself or freaking out or not liking living in California. Man, I tried to go to L.A. and go see that shit. I went and saw, well, I saw Mercury Rev one time. Mm-hmm. I see some, you know, Maskus. All these years I've been a dinosaur fan.
Yeah.
I remember one time leaving fucking Orange County, and you know, five and you try to get up to what, Trocadero or something, whatever.
Troubadour. Troubadour, on Sunset.
4 hours.
Yeah.
Of bullshit. 4 hours
to get up there.
80 miles, because there's an accident. There's something. You got to get rerouted. That's where I just knew this isn't. I don't care what this. What riches are here.
No, that's what'll do it to you. It's the same with me. It's like, this is never going to end.
It broke my heart.
The traffic.
I just didn't get to see my band, you know, Maskus or whatever, you know, whatever it was.
Because
of
bullshit.
Because it was just like fast and faster and fastest. And everyone's like, you know, there's a hierarchy. Who's the good looking ones? I'm with a bunch of surfers, man.
I get that, but you didn't get to see your band because there was a traffic.
I know,
problem.
But what I'm getting at is you get this awesome job with a great group of guys.
Right.
And then you're in a place where it's 90 fucking degrees every day, and I'm like, I'm near tears pulling up to my job every morning, you know, because it was just like, I want to be back in Minneapolis where it was gritty.
Yeah.
But I did the mag, but you get down there, and as a Midwesterner, I didn't quit the job. I got offered a job within 2 weeks at another place, didn't take it. Did my 2 year stint, you know, with my guys, and then I got rescued back to Portland. But see, that's my first like job, you know, and it was like, I was an art director for a snowboard mag, you know, and we got to see the mag in supermarkets in my hometown.
You did it.
I did it. One of my greatest stories. I just went home for the summer, a couple weeks. You know, I got picked on as a kid. Who didn't?
Right, yeah.
And I remember one of the guys that got one on me. You know, he was good looking. He had hair on his back. I remember that.
Yeah.
I was young. I was 12 when I started high school or whatever.
Yeah.
I was 13. And he got a couple on me.
Yeah.
I remember one time. I went back for my 10-year anniversary.
Yeah. You know, reunion?
Reunion.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got to bring back a whole pallet of magazines. So I go to, somewhere. I went to some sporting goods store to get something. And I'm going through the line, and he's the guy ringing up. Now, listen, I have nothing against guys in sporting goods stores for a living.
Right.
But I look, and I go, well, hey, what's going on? He said, well, look at you. You know, something to me.
Yeah.
Now, fine. And he goes, well, what are you doing? And I go, there's my mag in a rack. I go, I'm the art director of a snowboarding mag, and just fucking walked out. Anyway, fuck that guy, but I got to say that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that was just like poignant because I went out and had lived out west I snowboarded with my buddies, you know? Mm. And then I did it pretty gross along the way, you know? Got my school done. It was that moment where I realized I kind of did it.
Yeah.
And I was making $37,000 a year and not having a cent left over.
Yeah.
You know? But still could make it down to California.
Yeah.
Pay my rent and shit.
That's a good feeling to pursue something that you love and you believe in, and then you nail it, and then you got something to show for yourself.
You just don't really know if you're ever even gonna make it, and you're okay with that. You know,
right.
A summer in Alaska washing dishes, I could always go back to that.
Sure. Could go back now probably.
I would love to go up there just to quit. I have these fantasies about it. Just to fucking leave them high and dry. Because I wanted to quit every day, Mark. Every day.
In the middle
day,
of it?
In the middle of a run.
Yeah.
They fucking stop the train, and you're like out, and we're like, the guy died. That McCandless guy died out in the woods, you know, it's in the wild or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of shit.
Yeah.
We used to drive by that like 2 or 3 miles. And I always had these fantasies like, just fucking stop the train. You have to stop to let trains pass. And I'd be like, grabbing my Walkman. I'm just going to fucking hike out to the Fairbanks Highway or whatever, you know? That was every meal shift, because it just
was
hard to be up.
Where were you doing this dishwashing?
I was on a train washing dishes. We'd pick up all these old people, and they would, you know, on these big boats, Princess Tours, on the big cruise ships, Love Boat.
Yeah.
We'd get them on the Love Train. We'd pick them up 5 in the fucking morning. We'd feed them a couple meals, and we'd work our way up to Fairbanks.
Yeah.
And I'd work, 16 hours that day. Anything past 8 hours is overtime, right?
Uh-huh.
So you're making good money. And then everyone's stealing and shit. It was real fun, you know?
Yeah.
And you come back the next day, so that's 2 days, 32 hours or something. And, man, you got a whole work, you know, 4 days worth in those 2 days. You take a day off, do it again. Now, I would work extra shifts. So I'd work 6 of 8 days, you know, 7 of 8 days. And I did that for four summers.
Yeah. So you come up here to Portland after you go back home victoriously and teach that guy at the Sporting Goods store a lesson. Yeah, well, and what brought you back up here?
He was a dick. Well, I got a job. Now, I was telling you about my buddy John over here. He actually goes by Goo. But Goo called me and said, hey, we're called Cinco Design. We're looking for guys. You're in the industry of snowboarding. Do you know someone would want to come up to Portland? Do you know a young kid? And I said, yeah, man, fucking me. Get me out of here. So they flew me up.
Yeah.
I got to see Portland.
Yeah.
I didn't care. I didn't care, you know, how much money. It was just like, I got back to Portland.
Yeah.
And it was called Cinco Designs. It's, to this day, there was about 16 when I went there.
Yeah.
There's probably 70 people there now. It's an incredible place in town. But, you know, you get there. I'm instantly, you know, I get into this place. I'm instantly have to get on the plane to go back to California. You know, like a couple weeks later, you know, and it was like,
why?
Fuck. We worked for Nixon Watches. So, you know, you ever heard of Nixon Watches?
No.
Okay, well, this is the...
Oh, I remember. Yeah, I remember.
You know, Nixon. Yeah. This is out of Encinitas.
Yeah.
So this little brand...
They were an account.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you got this Cinco Design,
mm-hmm.
and you go in, and they are inventing these little brands. Gravis Shoes, Nixon Watches. These guys are coming up with these great ideas and saying, go. They make the logo. They make the whole look. We're making shoe boxes. We're making watches. Mm-hmm. So I got to work on the Nixon account right away. I mean, this is one of the cool, today, still, is one of the greatest action sport brands. They're way bigger than that now.
Yeah.
But back then, they were the pinnacle. And mm-hmm. I get to work for the place that makes the stuff. It was incredible, you know. But, you know, I did that 2 years, and I also got to see, you know, like meetings about meetings. And emails about emails, and you know, just we played ping pong all day and shit, and it freaked me out. You know,
but you did great. Some work. You're proud of.
I worked my ass off there. I'd stay late.
Were you getting recognized for your work?
Not really. Was never really about. No, we were just. I was making a good living.
Yeah.
I was making great money there. I think I made $65,000, man.
Yeah.
And that was a lot for. I was 30. You know, and I had my school out of the way, and I had already snowboarded, so I had some credibility to that shit. I'd lived it, you know, because you meet some rat fuck kid, and you're like, he's going to size me up for being big or being out of it, and I'll say, I lived in the mountains for 5 years, and I did that shit. Yeah. And then they'll be like, whoa, you know, whatever.
What's the alliance between, like, what you do and the advertising industry?
Oh, it's a little bit different deal, because they come to you with, I wouldn't know, man. I've been so lucky, my gross little path. We worked on small brands,
right.
But we'd make advertisements, but that's a little bit different.
But so that means that sometimes you're working for a company and you might have to deal with the advertising company
they hire. I mean, there's all kinds of elements.
Right,
but for the most part, here's this job making a good living,
right.
Working for cool with your friends. But, you know, that kid gives you the job from, you know, Burton Snowboards or whatever the hell we're working
for.
It's still cool stuff.
Now, okay, so you hit the wall after 2 years?
2 years.
And what do you do?
I quit.
To do what?
Get free.
Yeah.
That's where I got free. That was 2004.
And what'd you do then?
I went out on my own. I saved a bunch of cash. I bought a little house. I tricked out my basement. I had two little clients that were starting, Cole Headwear and Union Binding Company. So these are two little, so snowboard bindings and then headwear, like hats and beanies and shit. Uh-huh. And these are friends that are starting these things out of Seattle.
Right.
And I'm going to do the graphics. Right. So here I am at the Cinco Design where I'm watching these guys invent these Nixons and stuff. And I get to do this. Very small scale.
Right.
So that's enough for me to put my month in over there, jump out. My mom and dad freaked out because I bought a house.
They're like, why are you quitting your job?
Well, right.
Yeah.
Because that's just what, it's not what you do in the Midwest. You work forever until, you know, whatever.
Right. Till you break.
So I jump out, you know, it's 2004.
Yeah.
And, you know, start this Draplin Design Company, right? Whatever that meant. Like, I didn't even have I got a business license 3 years ago. That's a little secret for everybody who's listening, but I didn't even know you had to have one.
Right.
I just started working on my own. And that first year, I started to make money.
Mm-hmm.
I saved the fuck out of it. That little house I bought took me 5.5 years. I paid it off
mm-hmm.
with graphic fucking design. And working, there's been some big ones, but there were a lot of crusty ones. Because see, that little Union Binding Company, a little Cole Headwear, you get a nice little retainer.
Yeah.
The next year, you get a little more.
Yeah.
Like, 5%.
How long is what's the longest you've been with one client?
10 years and 10 years Union and Cole. These are my brothers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now have you been like I imagine in your industry that it's like any other industry, they're like recognition and like, you know, you have these mentors of yours. Yeah. Have they sort of like have you been like Aaron Draplin's the made guy? He's
well, I think because of the tour, you know, I'm a bit of an entertainer these days, Mark.
Uh huh.
And I have gone fucking everywhere. How many shows did you do last year?
A lot.
I did 41.
That's great. Well, what do you do out there? What are you doing?
So listen, I worked on clients for at least 5 or 6 years.
Right.
When I told you how I moved in here,
yeah,
that's when we started, you know, I brought all my clients in here. And I mean, I go back and look at those folders. There's 50 folders a year. That means there's 50 different jobs a year, right?
Yeah.
Of which two are big retainers.
Right.
A snowboard mag called Snowboard Mag that my buddies and I started.
Yeah.
And what, you know, started to like compete with the old mags we worked for. We started that thing here in my fucking basement.
Yeah.
Right? Sold it and shit when we were done with it. I mean, just to pay everyone back. But these are small, crusty little brands. These are indie bands, if you will.
Yeah.
That started to become real, you know? So I did that for a number of years, and then I got my first invite to go and talk. So I'm coasting along. I'm saving money. I'm working on stuff. I can't blur the line between whether or not I even like it, because they're my friends, and it's making logos, and it's making good work, and you're getting paid well. Everything was incredible. And this guy, David Carson, is a big, big fucking name in graphic design, like has books written about him and shit.
Yeah.
He dropped out of a gig, and these guys said, come and tell your story to us. That was 2009. So I did. And I went to Savannah, and I told my story, and I was scared shitless, getting up and, you know, holding the mic and all weird and sweaty, yeah, and the whole bit.
Right.
But that's where it started, and they liked to talk then. And we're 5 years in now, so it's been 192 shows.
That's great.
I've gone everywhere.
And you're talking to design students.
Design students, yeah, conferences,
right,
nerd conferences, coders, going to big agencies and just kind of riling them up, you know. And I got, you know, I've got some stories. I've got some tall tales, you know. That's what I call it, tall tales from a large man. Because, mm-hmm, I mean, they look at me as this big animal, and I am, but then there's a couple stories that really freak them out, you know. And I can't talk about them on here because you got to go see the live show.
Sure.
But it's just kind of like they're expecting, you know, action sports, things and stuff, yeah, and all, yeah, the bullshit I've been talking, right, about for years, and then I hit them with these things and they flip out. So, you know, it's meant to be fun, but I've gone everywhere talking.
Tell me about, you know, your dad before he passed, and your mom, is she around?
Yeah, my mom's around.
Oh,
yeah,
great.
Yeah, I just saw her 2 weeks ago. Yeah.
So was he able to enjoy all this stuff he put inside your head?
See, okay, I would take, see, my dad was funny,
yeah,
right? So when we stubbed our toe when we were kids, the first thing he'd say is, should I call a tow truck?
Uh-huh.
Now listen,
yeah,
I mean, bad jokes.
Yeah.
But also, he was known for putting his hands on some lady and saying, how many more months till the baby's done? And then she wasn't pregnant. She was,
sure,
48 years old. My, yeah, mom would get all pissed off. But he played Santa Claus, mm-hmm, for, like, poor kids.
Mm-hmm.
So he was gregarious and funny as shit. And, you know, I got to, you know, he got to open up a couple of my shows. What'd you call Dean last night? He was like, he's the opener? What do you,
yeah,
call it?
Yeah. The feature act.
Okay.
Yeah.
My dad was my feature act.
Featuring for you. Oh,
and he
great.
Told jokes. Here's one of his jokes, right? He said, yeah, what's the difference? He goes, this is a joke for, you guys are into color theory and graphic design. And he says, what's the difference between pink and purple?
What?
The grip. Get it? Yeah. You're the guy who writes jokes. The grip. If you fucking squeeze that thing, pink and purple.
Okay.
This is in front of 200 people.
How did
and
do?
My dad, they kind of gasped. My dad was telling jokes.
Yeah.
And he was still looking at me. I'd say, yeah, he wrote his stuff out because we grew up. Oh, man. We have so many jokes.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's what I remember from my dad is like all the bad jokes growing up.
Yeah.
It's just the idea that this is what we grew up around.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad entertaining our whole family, us. It's very quiet in our house now.
Mm.
Because my dad, you know, he just, you know, I don't know. Anytime we were working on math, he'd say, have you learned your gazintas?
Mm-hmm.
And he'd say, gazintas. He'd say, yeah, 2 gazinta 4, 2 times. Where does he get this shit? You know? I mean, these are old. They're like, because he's a salesman.
Sure.
And he went to tool shops with tough Harley-looking guys.
Yeah.
In town here, the kids play that kind of thing.
Right.
And motherfuckers make websites during the day. They got
right.
the look. My dad, we were raised around those guys. When you go into a tool shop, you break the ice, and he knew all the jokes. So remember, like, when the shuttle blew up and shit?
Yeah.
My dad knew all the Chris McAuliffe. You know, that's just, it's a currency these guys would know.
Sure.
And he would be on kind of stage with these guys. So, you know, that's, like, you know, that's what I remember. You know, I've got his last joke he told me,
mm-hmm.
the best one. You know, Aaron.
Yeah, go ahead.
Fuck it, let's do it. Okay. He says, hey, Aaron, you hear about the two mountain men walking in the woods?
Yeah.
And I says, yeah, yeah. He says, guy's walking. He says, hey, man, how you been? The guy goes, oh, I've been hunting, fishing, and trapping. He says, hey, I'm having a party at my cabin tonight. The guy goes, hey, I'm going to party at your cabin. What's going on? The guy says, oh, it's going to be great. There's going to be dancing. There's going to be fighting, fucking, sucking, eating, playing cards. The guy goes, shit, sounds like a good time. Who's all going? He goes, oh, it's just me and you. Yeah. That's my dad's last joke. He told me that the day before he died. Now, I never heard that joke. So to bring him in here,
yeah.
He would dig and he would see all my dead shit, yeah. Go through my drawers and just say, did you steal this from me? I said, yeah, you know, and we'd have this full circle.
Yeah.
He taught me that. He taught me how to clean things up when you're done with it. That's the anvil. You know, pound out all the metal pieces.
Yeah.
You know, all these other things. My dad taught me how to change brakes and change my oil and, you know, stuff that dads teach kids, you know. And yeah. If I need to, I got a Volvo now. It's beautiful, you know, yeah. And I don't need to have to even do that shit anymore. But it's like, you know, that's what he was from. But more importantly, just taught us how to laugh. You know, I know it sounds a little kind of almost kind of corny, but it's like, right. I'm so fucking thankful that my dad, when buddies would come over, my dad would like pull them aside and like, how you doing? Like hug them. You want a beer? You want a sandwich? You know, whatever. My dad had a fridge with 100 beers in it because you never knew when Wisconsin was going to invade.
Pizza,
you never know. 100 beers. And he wasn't a big drinker.
Right.
But it's like those little things. It's funny.
Yeah.
You know, and like some of the dads I go meet, you know, they'd be like pissed off that you parked in their driveway. Right. You know.
So your dad just had a good spirit.
I had him for 40 years. So, you know, I was all afraid that you'd be like, go look at my shit and say, what about your dad? But, man, I had him for 40 years. And, man, we are saving so much on groceries. So things are good, man.
Oh, good.
You know, I mean, it's, what do you do after someone dies? Where does he go? Is he just on the other plane or whatever? You know, or just on the other, what, planetary, you know, like cosmic. After my dad died, I don't really care what any of the superstitions are. I started to go read about the cosmos because if you go in one direction forever, that's real. You know, I liked how crazy you go on the thing and you talk about what you're into and how weird you are and all the neurotic this shit. I've had no time for that because I've just been out 14 grigum miles away, you know, wondering, where's my dad? You know, did he go to a higher plane? When you died, does he go? Because we were on a plane when he died. We were there on a plane. Uh-huh. And he died, and I got to say goodbye to him in front of 350 fucking people. You know, and it was like a Viking kind of thing or something.
What do you mean in front of 350
people? He died on a plane. We were flying back from Minneapolis, and we get taken off, and my dad kind of started to get... So, just so you know who you're fucking with, I'm a Delta Diamond flyer these days.
Yeah.
Just so you know.
Okay.
You a Delta Diamond?
No, American Platinum.
Someday you'll get there.
Okay.
But I get all these first-class upgrades now because of how much I've been going on the gigs. And that day... I got to upgrade to first class. So Lee and my mom and my dad are in the back seats, and I get upgraded. So I said, Dad, you're not feeling good. Go take the front seat. And he does, you know. And the plane takes off, and he just kind of, you know, before it took off, he said, I'm just not feeling good. I'm a little queasy. I just want to get back to Portland. Because what it was, we were back. I was doing my biggest show I've ever done for this AIGA show in Minneapolis. 2,500 people.
Yeah.
Like a fucking symphony hall, man. And I did my talk. I had 30 minutes. I did 45 minutes. Went over. I guess it's called killed. I got a standing O. And my mom and dad, they were in the crowd, and they got to see it. So, all right, because they tell you at the moment, they say, you know, when you see the light, we're going to take your picture for the DVD. All right. So you're supposed to do this. Put your hands together like the girl from Facebook did, you know, smart people. From my moment, I just went, Dad, I told you, right? Because I was fucking with my dad. Drove a Ford Tempo station wagon. And I showed a picture of him with this piece of shit station wagon, making fun of him. He loved it. And the next day, he fucking dies, right, on this plane. So we're coming back from Minneapolis to Portland because they were out here visiting us here in Portland. I'd bring him out every 3-4 months. You know?
Yeah.
And the plane takes off, and he just kind of slumped. And my mom was there. And he slumped, and then they're checking pulses and stewardesses and the whole deal. You know, this woman freaked out, kind of, and you know, they're all medical, whatever, but it's like he died on the plane. They were doing the whole deal, and, you know, I was right there, helped him get off. He was a big man. I helped him get off the seat onto the ground. There's all the people behind us praying and shit. I don't really remember all of it, but I
got to... Was there a doctor on the plane?
Some kind of veterinarian or something. Really? But she knew the basics of the vitals.
Yeah.
And they were like counting. And, you know, here's the worst moment of your whole life with your dad. But it's oddly okay. Because I had him, you know what I mean? It sucks because I wish my sisters would have been there. If that's the way it's got to go. We had to call them when we got off. They had to land the plane in somewhere in Montana. Because it's an emergency. And I'm thinking, you know, there's going to be like a fucking ambulance that comes and picks him up, and he's going to be on life support or something, because they're doing that stuff. You press it on his chest, and they got him sort of stabilized. He had a heart attack. Well, he died in the air. And they do that so we don't flip out, I guess.
Right.
They land the plane. A fireman came up to me and just said, "I'm sorry, son. We lost your dad." And I went, you know, I didn't lose it. I just went and laid with him and kind of said, "Hey, you know, I got to be with my dad when he fucking died and say goodbye." And then he dies, and they put him in a fucking ambulance, and you guard him. Yeah. Because, you know, oh, it's my dad. He was so fucking cool to Northern Michigan. And there were 500 people at his fucking funeral.
Yeah.
And Carol from the fucking UPS was there, and she'd say, "Your dad would come in every Friday," and he'd say, he'd make sure there was a line, he'd fill out the paperwork, and he'd say, "Carol, are there two J's in marijuana?"
That's a joke, right?
And she was crying.
So they had a good sound send-off. You had that moment. Is it awkward? But you're beautiful.
Very, very weird. But, you know, I talked to him every day. People send photos and paintings and things of my dad, because I celebrated him on my website.
Yeah.
I celebrated him on my fucking arm. That's my dad.
Yeah.
You know, he was incredible. My mom, Lauren Draplin, is just as incredible in a different, quiet way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my dad, he hogged the fucking limelight.
Sure.
But, you know, when your mom, when your dad goes like that, it really made me think just how wonderful my mom is.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
Because then, you know, it's just weird. We go home now, and it's just real quiet.
Sure.
My dad always had a Tiger game going, making soup. He would cut each bean twice for two farts for each bean.
Yeah.
See, now that I'm on a comedy podcast and trying to talk, you know, because he was fucking funny.
Yeah. Well, it's beautiful, man. I mean, it sounds like you fully integrated the spirit of your old man and with respect and reverence.
I got to show him. You know, sure. He saw me.
The hell of a night that last night.
He saw them in these things, you know. He would freak out. My mom would print things off of, you know, the websites and see. So for those years, I mean, it's been a year and a half. But, and I'm not counting days, but I got to share this shit with them. And on top of that, you know, I'd go home. I've done well. I've saved it all.
Yeah.
So, like, if he was watching his Tiger game on a small television, I'd go to Best Buy, buy him a big fucking 58-inch whatever, and freak him out. Because, you know, it flipped. My dad took care of us so well, and now
that's fucking beautiful, dude.
I took care of them. Beautiful. I still do.
Beautiful. Well, I think that's it's beautiful. The whole thing just really fucking amazing, and you're doing amazing stuff.
Well, thanks, man. Appreciate you coming in here. I got to thank Lee McColi, okay?
Yes.
Okay, I got to thank my little sister Leah and Jacob and Oliver. I got to thank my mom, Lauren Draplin.
Yeah.
I got to thank David and Goo and everybody else in my life. Thank you, guys. Lee McColi, everybody. Big fan of WTF. Lee McColi, she's going to go nuts. Okay, the show is done.
Good talking to you.
Thanks, man.
Compelling guy, that Aaron James Draplin. Cool stuff, too. I love those notebooks. But, like, it was a... That's fucking touching, man. He's a good dude, self-made dude, and interesting guy. I hope you dug it. What do we got here at the end? I don't know. Maybe go to WTFpod.com. Get some justcoffee.coop. What else? Get on the mailing list. Get the Howl Premium. Check out the shit. Huh? Do what you got to do. Guitar, maybe? You want to do a little guitar? Do I have a pick? I've been playing with going straight into these amps. This is the Black Beauty into the Little Beast. It's a 65 champ. That's what that is. That's what you're going to hear. Boomer lives!